On a Friday, you're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. We are going around the state touring historic cabins, and there are plenty of charming cabins that are tucked away in the North Woods or quiet rural areas perfectly suited for weekend hibernation. One stop is the edge of Muir Lake near the Dells. You can rent a Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home. It's the Seth Peterson Cottage in Delton. Shout out to that cottage. Maybe you don't have a private family cabin, but you still like to visit lodges and cabins around the state. What are your favorite ones? Where do you go? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe DeRose is a historian with the Wisconsin Historical Society State Historic Preservation Office. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first take an overview a little bit of cabins in Wisconsin. What are they like here, and how did cabin culture begin?
Sure. Yeah, tourism's always been a part of Wisconsin history. In the late 19th century, tourism started in the southern part of the state. As you can imagine, that's where most of the population was. Places like Lake Geneva got their start then. The wealthy of Chicago would come to Lake Geneva and spend their summers there to escape the heat of the big city.
May I say they still do?
I would think so.
Okay.
if you want to, you can actually experience part of this lifestyle. The Wisconsin Historical Society has a historic site down there called Black Point. It's an 1880s building. It's one of these summer retreats of a beer baron. So you can go down there and you can experience what it was like to live that lifestyle. But other places in the state also were tourist destinations. Waukesha, for instance, was a big destination for people from Chicago. They would go there to take the waters, bathe in the mineral springs, drink the mineral water for health purposes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Going into the start of the 20th century, though, people start to migrate up to the northern part, what we traditionally consider the tourist part of the state.
The North Woods.
The North Woods, exactly. But back in the turn of the century, the northern part of the state was known as the cutover. If you drew a line from La Crosse over to Green Bay, all the pine trees north of that were logged off. The landscape was dramatically different than it is today.
Clear cut?
Pretty much clear cut. Go to the Wisconsin Historical Society's website and you can see historic photos of what it looked like up there, and it is amazing how different it was. So you can imagine the land up there was very cheap. So people would buy large tracts of land for family retreats or private hunting cabins, hunting and fishing clubs. And they would build what they considered cabins, but these were architect-designed retreats, major compounds of a dozen or more buildings designed by architects.
More like lodges, maybe.
Exactly. It would be a main lodge with satellite cabins and other buildings associated with it. The style of architecture that was popular then was called rustic architecture. And what they would do is they would harvest logs and build the buildings out of it. So these were log cabins, but not the little house on the prairie log cabin. These were major buildings.
And were they harvesting the logs right from around the area?
Sometimes, but sometimes not. There's a place in Barron County called the Island of Happy Days, which was built by one of the Stout family members, heir to a lumber fortune. He got his logs actually from Washington State. He had them.
Oh, he imported them.
He imported. That building the compound cost over $1 million.
He's got all these logs around him, but he's decided to bring in logs from elsewhere.
Well, to make it even better, when he built the place in 1909, the building was designed by a Chicago architect, and it was designed, the logs had the bark still on them. So within a year or two, you can imagine what would happen. There were bugs everywhere, so he just tore the whole thing down and started over again, this time without bark on the logs.
Now, was that something novel and new? Was he just kind of experimenting, or was this a growing trend where you kept the bark on the log?
That would happen periodically. It was a little outside the norm, but the style of architecture, rustic architecture, it harkened back to the Adirondacks of upstate New York. That's where decades earlier there were great camps, again, by the elite, and they would build with native materials, stone, wood, whatever was available, but they were large-scale buildings.
We're talking with Joe DeRose. He is a historian with the Wisconsin Historical Society State Historic Preservation Office, and we're going around the state exploring cabins. Do you have a family cabin that's been passed down through the generations? Did you grow up visiting a cabin as a kid? Where is it? What are your memories of it? What questions do you have about particular cabins you see from the road? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. When you talk about the island of happy days, what do we see of that today? Because this was a cabin built in, you know, an area built up in 1909.
Mm-hmm. The property is still there. You can actually go visit it. It has a restaurant that you can go to. There are still rooms that you can rent there. It's on an island, so it's kind of cool to get to.
So how do you get to it?
I believe by a little ferry. Okay. I've never actually been to it. I've only seen pictures of it. But to give you a sense of the scale of this, nearby is the farm that they had that produced fruit, vegetables, and meat for the summer visitors. And when we think of a farm, we think of the quaint little red barn. Once again, that's not the case. These are massive brick barns, 100, 150, 200 feet long. Again, architect designed, but you get a sense of the whole scale of what was going on at that time.
Let's look at another place, Forest Lodge in Bayfield County. Take us there.
Yeah, that's another one of these family retreats. It got its start in the late in 1893 as a single cabin. Mm-hmm. And then it was remodeled in 1914 and again in the 1920s. These family retreats were very organic because they stayed in families for generations. So it's not uncommon for them to be changed and morph over time.
And this is in the town of Namekagon?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so what do we see there when we go to this? There's a lake of the same name, and this is rustic buildings. But what are the nuances?
Well, you get a sense of the whole landscape that was going on there. It's not just the buildings. They were trying to get back to nature, but with modern conveniences. So they had stone walls. They had a picnic area. A path and road systems were put in. You got to remember, about 1900, this was a pretty desolate area. So any type of road system is a major convenience up there.
And it was remodeled in the early 1900s, in the late 20s, in the 30s. I'm wondering what the remodels did to the structure, because remodels can sometimes not go so well in terms of preserving history.
No, that's not the case with Forest Lodge. When you go there, it's like stepping back in time. It's actually administered by between the Forest Service and Northland College, I believe, and you can rent out a couple of cottages and stay there. But no, it is like stepping back into another era when you go there.
Well preserved.
Yes.
That's what we like to hear. We're touring cabins around the state with the Wisconsin Historical Society's Joe DeRose as our guide. Are you hoping to have your own cabin one day? Will you buy and refurbish an old cabin or start from scratch? What are your ideas for it? Join in with cabin stories, questions about cabins you've seen from the road. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with survey historian Joe DeRose right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're touring remarkable cabins all around the state. It is Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As a kid, we rented the same cabin every summer. It was in Two Harbors, Stonegate Lodge, cabin number one. It had a potbelly stove for warmth. It had running water, but it was really cold. And the bunk beds in the living room were all in one room. But that picture window view of Lake Superior, the waves would pound the rocks, this tiny cabin perched on the edge of jagged rocks, it was terrifying in the dark of night. And there was the steady, rhythmic white flash of light from Split Rock Lighthouse right there in the window, and it would light up the cabin like a camera flash as you'd fall asleep to the pounding waves. And, oh, I miss it. I didn't appreciate the beauty until I was so much older. Perhaps you know Stonegate or a cabin like it. Share your cabin stories, 800-642-1234. Joe DeRose is a historian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Joe, you know, even around the Great Lakes, there are so many beautiful cabins. And on Lake Superior especially, you're just right perched there on the rocks.
Yeah, no, it's a great part of the state. Wisconsin's blessed by having Great Lakes on two of our borders, so you have a lot of natural beauty. One of my favorite places is in Door County. It's called The Clearing. It was founded in 1935 by Jens Jensen, who is arguably the greatest landscape architect in the United States at that time. He founded The Clearing in 1935, but before this, he was instrumental in setting up the Chicago Park system. He designed landscapes for private estates of the elite, like Henry Ford, the Florsheim family, the Armors, other important industrialists. Then in 1935, he started acquiring property for The Clearing. He felt that the environment has a profound effect on people, and that understanding one's own ecology and culture is fundamental to clear thought. So he designed this as a getaway, and it still operates as that today. You can go there, you can sign up for classes, they're week long, and you can live in the buildings and
clear your mind.
I don't think there's cell phones allowed there, you know. I mean, it's just get away from it all. And so Jens Jensen would be very proud of how it's still being used.
What was the folk school element of it?
Getting back to nature.
Okay.
You know, just being in touch with one's surroundings.
Take us to Peacock Inn in Vilas County.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier about these family retreats designed by architects. Well, like any type of architecture, there's the high-style architecture designed by architects, and then it kind of filters down to the masses. And local carpenters, builders, they interpret it their own way. The Peacock Inn is in St. Germain in Vilas County. It was built in 1930, and it's one of these examples of kind of the trickle-down effect of architecture, if you will. It's rustic architecture. It's a log building, but it's not as huge as Island of Happy Days. I mean, it's a roadside inn. Mm. It was built right on the highway. It's a reaction to the increase in auto travel, which is becoming popular then. So when you go there, the outside's pretty nondescript. It's just logs, but when you go inside, the bar is one of the most beautiful you'll ever see. It's made with local logs and bent saplings that are just arranged in artistic and whimsical fashions. I mean, it's just a real work of art. And
that's from the original structure.
Correct. That dates back to 1930. You can still go in there. It's a restaurant now. There's a cottage out back that you can rent. I think that's a more modern building, but you can still go to the Peacock Inn and eat.
And inside the inn, you can eat, but you can't stay inside?
I don't believe so.
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
So you mentioned, too, that this was built alongside the road. Mm-hmm. Did you find that cabins were being built up around basically roads that were being built in the areas?
Right. That's what's going on in the early 20th century. You start to have road systems being developed in the northern part of the state. So the service industry, if you will, is popping up along the roads. For instance, there's a lodge over in Manitowish Waters called Voss's Birchwood Lodge. Mm. And this is very indicative of this trend. It got its start around 1910. It's been in the same family ever since. back in 1910, people would take a train up to Manitouche Waters, and a wagon would pick you up and take you to the resort, which consisted of a main lodge and then some satellite cabins. And then you would eat your meals in the main lodge, and then you would go back to your private cabin. But then as we go on into the 20th century, automobiles start to replace the trains, and people start driving there. And so the Voss's Birchwood Lodge kind of evolves. It gets more cabins because more people can start to come.
We're talking with Joe DeRose. He's a historian with the Wisconsin Historical Society State Historic Preservation Office. We're visiting with him on a tour of cabins all over Wisconsin. And maybe you're packing up and headed to a cabin this weekend. Where do you go? What's your favorite cabin for a roaring fire this time of year? Long winter's nap. Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You also have some interesting things around the town of Sugar Creek in Walworth County, the Wandawega Inn. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, it is. And
in the neighborhood?
No, you're absolutely right. Wandawega Inn is now known today as Camp Wandawega. And when people talk about history, they love stories that are affiliated with properties, and every building does have a story to tell.
And they come to you to find it out, right?
Well,
they come to
sometimes.
The Historical Society
exactly.
And say, what's the story about my cabin or about my home?
Yes, and we have a lot of information about that. Wandawega has one of the most colorful histories that you're going to find anywhere. It's a story that of a resort that has changed with the times and remade itself several different times. It was first constructed in 1927, so this is during the Roaring Twenties, and it got its start as a lodge and a hotel and several small cabins, but it also had a tavern. Remember, you're not supposed to be selling alcohol then, and the tavern was known as Orphan Annie's at that time.
So it's a speakeasy.
It's a speakeasy. It was shut down. Sometimes it was operational. Local authorities would look the other way. Eventually, there was a murder-suicide there, and the governor got involved with the investigation. I don't know all the details about that, but then the original proprietor was then sent to prison, and the place shut down. After World War II, it reinvents itself as a more family-friendly type of resort where you could go and swim and boat and fish and, you know, stay
under
in the cabins.
Under new ownership?
Okay. yes. And it was run by a Polish family, so you could get home-style Polish cooking there. And then in 1961, it changes yet again. The property is purchased by Latvian Catholic priests. There was a sizable Latvian group that settled in Chicago after World War II, and they would come to Camp Wandawega to have tennis matches, basketball, things like that, and it was a big Latvian getaway for several decades.
Wow. What is it like today?
Now it's remade itself yet again. It's back to being a more traditional resort, but the arrangement they have with the local town is that single units cannot be rented out. You have to rent it out for like weddings, groups, large scale things for a couple of nights. So it has kind of an odd ability to be rented, but it's definitely worth it. It's a very distinctive property.
What about in Columbia County, Durward's Glen? What is this glen like? The person behind this property.
Yeah, this is Wisconsin has a very eclectic history, and this is an example of that. This is not really a resort, but it's a family retreat. But it was set up because of a spiritual nature. The Glen, it's named after Bernard Durward, who was from Scotland. He was born in 1817, came over to Milwaukee. He was an artist, and he moved to this area in 1862 and was really smitten with the natural beauty. And He actually had a religious conversion and became Catholic, and the place stayed with his family for decades because they were so physically attached to it. And then after they passed away in 1932, it became a novitiate for the St. Camillus Order.
And what I'm hearing here, Joe, is that cabins have many different iterations of who they are through the generations. I really appreciate you taking us on this tour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
Us.
My pleasure.
Joe DeRose is a historian with the Wisconsin Historical Society State Historic Preservation Office. Coming up next, we take a dive into the long and surprising history of log cabins in America. Did you build with Lincoln logs as a kid? I did. Is there a log cabin you want to know about? We're at 800-642-1234. Back for more cabin culture and Wisconsin Weekend. We have the author of the book, The Log Cabin, right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And just a side note here on our programming, the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes at noon, with the trial moving to a period of debate. You can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Over here in the Ideas Network, we'll keep you up to date on the latest and invite you into the conversation for analysis. Right now, we're celebrating our favorite cabins and talking about the historic ones in Wisconsin. I want to give a shout out to my aunt and uncle's cabin on Lake Sullivan. Sully, they call it, about 30 miles out of Brainerd, Minnesota. Growing up with the cousins, lots of long days water skiing, card games, Scrabble late into the night. Oh, and that outhouse for backup that everyone avoided. Keldy emailed us to say that they love the Mission Inn and cottages and all of the Nebraska Row cottages on Madeline Island from the early 1800s. I want to get there. What is the most interesting or memorable cabin you've ever seen? Have you visited historical Wisconsin lodges or log cabins? What do you think of them? 800-642-1234. Andrew Bolonsky is the author of The Log Cabin, an Illustrated History. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Sounds like you have a long love affair with log cabins. What draws you to them? Why are they so special?
I have to admit that I don't know if my love affair with them is that long. I will say they've always been in the background of my life. I grew up in Ohio, which I imagine, like Wisconsin, we had a lot of pioneer days growing up where you learned about, the frontiers people who lived in cabins, you know, prior to you. And then I went to summer camp in Bemidji, Minnesota, where we stayed in log cabins. Mm. But that exposure was very much relegated to my childhood. And I didn't really even think about them too deeply in adulthood until I just started doing some research on them. They came up sort of randomly in some other research I was doing. And I wanted to know more about why log cabins were so important to American culture and why we adored them. So I started doing some research and I found that what I thought was wrong. And so that sort of began my fascination with them and why I decided to write this book.
Wait, what was wrong? Where were the inconsistencies as you looked into their history and in the research?
I guess the two big things is I had this impression that log cabins, and I think this is probably through a lot of the iconography that we see around Thanksgiving, that log cabins had been present in Jamestown or in Plymouth, that, you know, the English colonists came over and they just set up shop in log cabins, and that is not really what happened. What happened was that Swedish and Finnish colonists came over in 1638, and they used log cabins because that was their native architecture from back home. And for, you know, 70 or 80 years, they were really the only people using log cabins because English colonists thought that they were above cabins. You know, they would rather live in a frame house. And it wasn't until primarily Germans, but also Irish, immigrants started coming over in the early 18th century that the cabin spread. So that was something I did not know and I found to be very fascinating. And the other aspect that I found to be intriguing was that log cabins have a very dark side. You know, we Americans and other people in the world sort of adore cabins as these safe spaces. They're romanticized as the frontier home or as an escape from the hustle and bustle. But they also were prisons for millions of enslaved people, and they were a tool of assimilation in dealing with native populations. So that sort of darker aspect that we don't often acknowledge was also very fascinating.
And perhaps a statement of your social class. And, you know, even by the home you are living in, it reflected who you were in society.
Yeah, I mean, for the first century and a half, well, maybe not that long, but century for sure, cabins were seen as, you know, something that you had to escape, that you didn't want to be known as living in a log cabin. And if you couldn't escape that log cabin, you would cover it up with clapboard, which is why, you know, these days people will be renovating a house and suddenly come across a clapboarded cabin in the corner of, you know, their mansion in the woods, because people had a lot of shame around their cabins, so they wanted to cover them up or use them as the corner for a larger, more grand house.
Oh, wow. So those walls can, if they could talk, they can really tell you about a lot of things going on socially from when they were built.
Yeah, and often, not always, but often the way they're constructed can tell you about, you know, the ethnic background of the people who constructed it as well.
Talking with Andrew Bolonsky, his book is The Log Cabin, An Illustrated History. You can join in with your questions about log cabins, 800-642-1234. Tony emailed us to say the open-air concept of her family's cabin allows the homegrown white pine to shine like the day it was built, and you can still smell the wood as if it were just cut. And it really makes Tony feel up north when they get there. What is the most interesting or memorable log cabin you've ever seen? What are your questions about their history? Join in 800-642-1234. Andrew, how did log cabins transform over the years from these utilitarian structures for ultimately lower classes to these, you know, just extravagant vacation homes for those who could afford it?
Well, it happened sort of in phases. Initially in the 1820s, after the War of 1812, Americans were really trying to coalesce a unified identity. You know, the post-colonial period was now over. We were America. We were trying to become our own thing. And the romantic artists and writers of that era started to play up cabins as an essential quality of the American experience and character. So that sort of solidified the cabin as an ideal in the imagination. And then they took on grander proportions, I guess, in the 1870s to 1880s, 1890s, when industrialism was really ramping up. And, well, there was more money, so people could afford to build larger cabins. But they also wanted to escape technological changes, much like people today. So wealthy people would build massive log cabin mansions in the woods, and it sort of became a status symbol to be able to escape the urban decay that people were experiencing, I guess.
And even the presidents lived in log cabins. Of course, we think of Abraham Lincoln, but there were others like Roosevelt, Grant, who really heralded the cabins.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that speaks to how ubiquitous cabins had become by that point. But the big turning point was in 1840, which some people might remember from elementary school, is called the log cabin election. And that's when this man, William Henry Harrison, who went on to win the election, he was very wealthy and he was from Ohio, and his campaign managers, which back then was still a very new concept, they realized, they saw the changing zeitgeist. They saw that the pioneer and working class people were becoming more popular within the American imagination. So they decided to take this wealthy candidate and pretend as if he lived in a log cabin. So they created this huge myth around him that he was, you know, this humble farmer. He lived in a cabin, much like so many millions of voters. He was just like them. And it created this sort of mania across the country where the log cabin was, it was etched on everything from tea sets to hairbrushes. There were big parades with log cabins carried down the road, all for this candidate. And that was really the pivotal point when log cabins became a political tool. And when candidates started to emphasize their humble origins rather than, you know, saying, I'm a John Quincy Adams, I herald from the founding fathers, and I have all this experience, I'm worldly. Now candidates wanted to be just like you or me.
And it almost sounds like there was a whole type of propaganda out there, if you will, around this whole concept of log cabins.
Yeah, there was. And there were so many speeches and newspaper articles that equated living in a cabin with automatic honesty and integrity, which was, of course, a huge change from the early 1700s when being in a cabin was seen as, you know, sort of trashy. So the art and culture of the 1820s helped lay the foundation for that turning point in the 1840s. And from then on, almost every single presidential candidate found a way to link themselves to the cabin.
Greg called in, and he couldn't stay with us, but he has a question. He was wondering how cabins were marketed back before we had really sophisticated communication and technology where you had online booking. How were cabins marketed?
Newspaper ads. I found a lot of newspaper ads advertising vacation cabins that people could rent or that they could buy oftentimes. Primarily the newspaper, and I imagine, you know, probably local bulletins.
Yeah.
In that way.
So as you look at your research with log cabins, do we still have the remnants of the social divisions in log cabins? And do they still retain some of this history that you're talking about that even blends itself into politics? Is it still there?
I would say that the social aspect has switched. Now I feel like cabins are a luxury, even if it's just a one-room cabin that someone goes to on the weekend. Like, you have the luxury of having a weekend to go to that cabin. And the social aspects, it's shifted, I think, especially politically. It sort of feeds into the whole self-made person myth. Mm. that we appreciate so much in the United States. And so even if a cabin isn't directly invoked, if you have a wealthy candidate who's trying to pretend as if they came from nothing, or a candidate who takes off their blazer and rolls up their sleeves to walk down Main Street, I think that all of that can be traced directly to the cabin's rise within the political imagination.
Log cabins were brought to the New World by settlers from Sweden and Finland. As we're learning, it was a traditional housing style. We have Andrew Bolanski as our guide, author of The Log Cabin, an Illustrated History. Still time for your questions about the history of American log cabins. Did you grow up visiting log cabins as a kid? Did you play with Lincoln Logs? Join in with your memories of cabins, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back with Andrew Bolanski in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We've arrived at Friday, and it's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring the history of cabins in Wisconsin, rustic cabins that dot our landscape, a link to the past. Stephen from Milwaukee emailed us to say that Stephen's getaway isn't as impressive as some of the others, but loves the serenity. It's on the Wolf River flowage just outside of Crandon, and it's a refuge, Stephen says, a place to recuperate from day-to-day life. You can join in with your cabins you love, 800-642-1234. The log cabin author, Andrew Bolanski, stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Darcy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Darcy.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your cabin?
I have a 1930 cabin. It's a faux log cabin that's up in Cascade, Wisconsin. It's on Lake Ellen. And I bought it about 3 or 4 years ago. It really needed a lot of work at the time. It sits on traditional piers, and the piers had failed. The floor was sagging, and I spent a lot of time and effort, but I've got it pretty much restored now. It's a pretty neat cabin. It's got the logs for the rafters. It's the old, I think I was told it was like a Swedish cut or something where the logs sit flat on each other. And it's modernized. It has plumbing inside and all that other stuff. But it's really great. I love it.
Do you go there year round?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I go there every weekend.
Very cool. Darcy, thank you so much for sharing that. Andrew, Darcy describes the cabin where the logs sit flat on each other. What about this style?
I can't remember the name of the style, but that does ring a bell about the Swedish particular notches that they created. I must admit that I focused more on the history and culture than the architecture part, but that does.
Yeah. How do the cabins stand the test of time? You know, Darcy has had to do a lot of upkeep and remodeling, you know, certainly with the piers on the floor. How do log cabins do over time?
I think it depends largely on how it's originally constructed, but I think that, you know, if the gaps between the logs are filled right, it stops moisture from getting in, and you know, obviously trees are very good at sustaining themselves. They're not schlacked or anything like that. So it's just the power of nature,
yeah,
of resilient, durable materials.
Well, let's go to Connie now in Arcadia. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I just wanted to share, I'm obviously up in age, but when I was in third and fourth grade, our family lived in a log cabin for a couple of years. Dad sold the farm, didn't have any idea what to do next, and there was this empty building not too far away, and no electricity, no plumbing, but it did provide a roof over our heads while we needed it, till we moved on to better things.
What is the state of the cabin today, Connie?
Oh, it's gone. It's long gone.
Oh.
It was on a farm in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. And I don't know, after we left, I really paid no attention to it. And it never seemed, you know, it's not something you... I used to live in a log cabin.
Yeah. So, well, it certainly helped Connie here through a time of transition, Andrew. They had a roof over their heads.
Yeah, and that seems very much, the way that cabins were utilized for so many millions of people throughout the centuries. And that's what I found to be very beautiful about the cabin. I mean, the dark side aside, the way that the cabin was really a vehicle toward freedom for so many people, particularly immigrant populations who came on to rely upon it, and really are the people who made the cabin as ubiquitous across the landscape as it is.
Yeah, and those cabins hold so much history. Still more to research?
Oh, my gosh. People could write about this topic for forever. There's so many little rabbit holes that you go down, so many personalities that you encounter that I wish I could have spent more time. So many different aspects of the American psyche are made understandable by looking at the cabin, which is what I found to be so compelling.
Andrew, thank you for sharing with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Bolanski is author of The Log Cabin, an Illustrated History. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a comedian with a story about Super Bowl parties.
With the Super Bowl coming up right around the corner, Madison comedian Esteban Tuma is struggling with whether or not to attend his friend's party.
Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Hey, Charlie, it's Esteban. Thanks for inviting me to your Super Bowl party again, but I'm going to have to think about it. It's just, yeah, well, I'll let you know. Thanks, bud.
You knew that. No, you didn't know that. Okay, they're called garbanzo beans. Yeah, obviously,
you can give me any food test you want. Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Hey, it's me again. So, the first time you invited me 4 years ago, I was excited. As a foreigner, it was cool to be included in the celebration, to run around the aisles of the supermarket, tucking a 30-pack of Coors Light with the same determination of that offensive player that gets handed the ball and runs with it. You know, the one behind the quarterback. I thought it would be a great chance to learn about football and this country. But after half a decade, I still don't understand Super Bowl parties, and I don't understand this country, so I'm not sure. Anyway, okay, yeah. See you.
Four large cloves of garlic. Four large cloves of garlic.
Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Just to be clear, it's not because I don't understand football. I get it. And I honestly enjoy the game. I don't mind the 12 minutes of real action over 3 hours. And it's fun to watch chronic traumatic encephalopathy happening live from 5 different angles. I'm even willing to forgive the use of the word football, which you have taken so blatantly for yourselves, like the name America or foreign oil. Too political? Whatever. I just don't feel like going this year. I hope you understand, but no hard feelings, okay?
It's effectiveness, how it smells over time. So buy small containers because if you leave it there and it's dry.
Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Also, how can you prefer football to soccer? Is it just because the rest of the world loves it? It's like the metric system, which, to be fair, is really complicated if you don't know how to count to 10. So yeah, maybe I'll go to your Super Bowl party once you come to my World Cup party, Charles. Do we have a deal? And what's with all the food at the Super Bowl party? Are we all training to be one of those offensive tank men, or whatever that position is? It's offensive eating, that's what. Yeah, I can watch down 6 more deviled eggs with another Coors Light, but should I? I'll have to live with myself the next day, knowing I have absolutely no concern for the safety of my own end zone.
A teaspoon of kosher salt. 3/4 little tea kosher salt. 3/4 little tea. Why not?
Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Dude, what is so great about the commercials? Oh, hey, it's Esteban again. Is the game so boring that you get excited about switching to Geico? And every year, the only real winner is capitalism. But this year, I win by not going.
Hey, it's Charlie. Leave a message.
Hey, Charlie. Sorry, I maybe got a little carried away. But honestly, it felt good to get that off my chest. And I guess that's what a Super Bowl party really provides. The ads that try too hard, the mild nudity during the halftime show, the poor food decisions, lots of bad beer. It's all there to give us a chance to connect as Americans about what we love. But more importantly, the things we love to hate. So I am for sure coming, and I'll be there an hour early with a jumbo nacho platter. And please have the deviled eggs ready. I have a record to break.
Esteban Tuma is a comedian from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on the morning show. What's happening in your part of the state that could reach all corners of Wisconsin? Send your ideas for Wisconsin Weekend to mornings@WPR.org, and we'll explore your tip for a future Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Wisconsin Weekend on the morning show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.